religious language. We're now going to consider whether religious beliefs and claims can be understood in a different way, a way which will suggest that in spite of these claims being very different to those that we make about the world on the basis of sense experience, that they are still meaningful. After all, senses are not involved in the same way in the experience which are referred to in religious claims. This way will suggest that religious claims are meaningful. They do tell us something. They tell us of a commitment to a certain way of life. We can refer to this as a non-realist position. However, this is not to devalue the meaning of religious claims and beliefs. Here, such beliefs still count as truth as long as they cohere within a system of beliefs. That is, they fit together like a giant spider's web. All experience requires interpretation. A good starting point for this is ordinary perception. John Hick reminds us that perception is not simply registering what is out there. It might seem to be a straightforward matter with perceptions of, say, mugs or dogs or trees and pens, but it is not. The point is that we do not just see things, we see as. Take a pen, for example. Seeing it as requires more than simply perception. It requires recognition, bringing it under a concept which gives it meaning. After all, you're not going to try to eat with it, are you? Think of a primitive cave dweller who had never seen one before and how different his or her experience of the pen might be. Think back to the duck-rabbit picture. Look at it and think rabbit. Glance away. Think duck. And look back at it. Just experiencing is not enough. Experiencing requires more. It requires interpretation. It is a case of experiencing as. Hick argues that religious experience is a kind of experiencing as. This means that the religious person experiences all of life as an encounter with God, as well as an encounter with the physical world and with other people. His or her religious belief is an extra layer of experience as a perspective on life and on the world that the non-religious person lacks. However, it might be said that perceptual experience is very different to the religious experience. Sense experience is universal and requires sense information. Religious experience does not, and some would say that at this point the analogy breaks down. Religious experience, perceiving the significance and the meaning of events, is close enough to the perceptual experience of mugs and trees and pens, says Hick, because it involves interpretation, concepts, and responses in just the same way. The same process happens in both. With the religious experience, the believer is having a sense of God in the world. It brings meaning and changes how the believer acts in the world. We'll consider the status of such a claim and ask if religious hypothesis can be justified as a real hypothesis, giving us real knowledge and being meaningful. An hypothesis is a proposal which needs to be tested, and we will need to consider the possibility of evidence for the religious claim. We'll visit the verification principle and the falsification principle and Flew's demand. We'll look at his parable of the gardener. In light of this, can religious claims and beliefs be said to hold meaning? As part of our inquiry, we'll explore Wittgenstein's use of language. We'll note his shift from the early position, similar to the verification principle, where language mirrors the world and is meaningful if it corresponds to facts in the world, and his later position, wherein the meaning of language is found in the understanding of the language game employed and how the words are used. Here, religious claims must be seen in the context of the religious life. The upshot of all this will be to highlight the possibility that religious claims need not necessarily be judged true or false, as they are not like statements of fact. This move towards a non-realist account would suggest that religious belief and claims mirror the attitudes of the believer. They express a way of life, a code or guide for living, an attitude and a commitment and an intention to act. Some might say this removes such claims from reason. Of course, this might simply be a reinterpretation of religious belief, an account which is too reductionist, removing the reality from it, and not one which is acceptable to most religious believers who would want to claim more for their position. The bottom line here can be expressed as this question: does the claim of religious believers simply mirror their attitudes rather than the facts? Wittgenstein's account of language. We've seen how seeing as suggests that we interpret our experience of the world in a certain way. In the case of religious claims, the believers see the world as an encounter with God. It is possible to put forward a non-realist account of such claims. After all, they are not claims about reality in the same way that scientific claims are. They cannot be verified or falsified. Perhaps they do not relate to a real, objective truth. Rather, they mirror the believer's attitudes and commitments. Wittgenstein's analysis of language offers an insight into how words are meaningful and has been interpreted in this non-realist way. Wittgenstein's early work influenced the Vienna Circle and was in keeping with what we call verificationism, the use of the verification principle. Basically, words convey meaning only when they correspond to or picture a fact in the world that reflects sense experience. This would reduce religious claims to nonsense. They become meaningless. Wittgenstein's later work understood language in a completely different way. He now argued that we cannot understand language and what it means without understanding the way in which language is used and how it interacts with how we live and what we do. He now attempted to illuminate and make clear the nature of language by comparing language to games. In particular, like games, language is an activity guided by rules. In games, the rules govern what one can do. In language, the rules govern meaning. Meaning is learned from the rules governing the use of the word or the sentence. Just like pieces in a game, chess pieces, for example, are understood by how they can be used. Meaning is then a matter of how words are used. Appreciating this requires a distinction between surface and depth grammar. On the surface, words describing something might be similar in two different contexts. At the surface level, they're similar. For example, to say the footballer passes the ball is similar to saying the love of God passes all understanding. To understand this particular piece of language, the word here, passes, is crucial to understanding. We need to look at how the words are used in each particular game. The meaning is not given in the form of the word alone. When looking at how words are used, we need to look at the language game, that bit of language and the rules that govern it. This is what gives it its meaning: asking, thanking, cursing, praying, so on. The idea of language games emphasizes the foundation of languages in activity. Wittgenstein says that a language game is the speaking part of a form of life. This is the foundation of all language games, the collection of cultural practices which we use. So religious language must be understood as part of a religious life. Religious language contains the many different language games of praise, worship, prayer, miracles, and so on. And it can also be understood as forming a language game in its own right, governed by its own particular rules, those displayed or revealed in the analysis of its depth grammar. Wittgenstein would say that whilst its surface grammar can look empirical, as though, like science, it is talking about things and events, this is misleading. A central part of Wittgenstein's analysis is that God exists is not a statement of fact. It is not about a thing, an object that exists in a part of the world like trees or cups or carpets. It's not a claim about an entity at all. It's not an empirical belief. It is really a way of living, a way of seeing and understanding life, and a commitment to act in a certain way. If we look at how the claims and beliefs are used, we see that they are not expressing a description of a fact, but a commitment. So talk of heaven is not about an actual place. It's not an empirical claim which can be verified. It's expressing the believer's emotional attitude. The verification principle.
The verification principle tells us that sentences are only meaningful if they're connected with the world. That is, that they describe it truly or falsely. My claim, for example, that there is a cat or a dragon in the room is meaningful because it tries to tell us something about the world. It doesn't matter whether it's true or false, it is still painting a picture of the world. A.J. Ayer, 1910 to 1989, was influenced by Wittgenstein's early philosophy. You remember that Wittgenstein split his philosophy about language into two phases. So Ayer was influenced by Wittgenstein's early work and by the group of Austrian philosophers known as the Vienna Circle. These philosophers, also known as logical positivists, wanted to clarify what could meaningfully be said or written. They argued that language claims were only meaningful if they were confined to human experience. If we try to step beyond this, then it becomes nonsense. Ayer's seminal work, Language, Truth and Logic, was hugely influential in presenting this idea. Here he put forward the verification principle, which is a kind of test that a sentence must pass if it is to be considered genuinely meaningful. In this context, a sentence is meaningful if it is either a tautology, that is, true by definition, or if it can be hypothetically proved to be true or false, that is, if it is verifiable. If a proposition is not a tautology and there is no possible empirical way of discovering its truth or falsity, then, according to Ayer, it is meaningless. Unless we can verify or know what could count as verifying a proposition, that claim about the world, the claim is factually insignificant and meaningless. There's no way to check the truth or falsity of such a claim. For example, it snowed in Bedford on the 1st of January 2007 is verifiable by records, so it is meaningful. There is a cat on this desk is verifiable by current experience, so it is meaningful. However, there was a problem for general claims, like water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. The problem here is that we cannot empirically test all of the water in the world. Most of science is made up of such generalizations. Ayer's principle was modified. A proposition was now deemed meaningful if we know what observations would be necessary in order to verify it. And here we now have a distinction between strong verification, wherein we can verify a statement by our own observation and so establish the truth or falsity of it for certain. For example, Mary has red hair. And weak verification, wherein there are some observations that could establish the probable truth of the statement, water boils at 100 degrees. Historical statements, such as Julius Caesar landed at Deal in 55 BC, cannot be verified in the strong sense, that is, they can't be absolutely verified. But there are recorded observations to count towards weak verification. Futuristic statements, for example, there is life on Mars, are meaningful because we do know what, in principle, would be required to verify them as being true or false. The verification principle is not saying that all these claims are true, merely that they are meaningful as they are factually significant. They are telling us something about our world. The verification principle is not saying that we can verify all of the claims, merely that we could do so in principle. Religious claims fail because the claim for a non-empirical reality cannot be verified either in practice or in principle. The same would count for moral statements. After all, the basis of the claim lies outside of human experience. There is no evidence for that, and therefore it cannot be verified. Criticisms of the verification principle. 1. The verification principle is not verifiable under its own terms. The verification principle cannot be verified using the verification principle. 2. John Hick says religious claims will be and can be verified after death. He says then that the truth of God's existence will be proved true or false. So they do meet the verification principle requirement, but this is eschatological verification. We'll talk later about the parable of the celestial city. 3. Some might say that the evidence of design in the universe counts for weak verification. That it is possible or probable that there is a designer behind it, or that the gospel records of Jesus' resurrection also fulfill this weak verification requirement. After all, the claims of Jesus' resurrection are a historical claim like any other. And 4, it seems that the verification principle rests on the idea that language pictures reality. How can we climb out of our own experience to check that our experience, ideas, and words match with the reality out there? Surely all of our experience is limited to our perspective. Without an objective standard, we cannot judge between the worldviews, perspectives, and claims of ourselves and others. They are all relative. And finally for this podcast, John Hick's parable of the celestial city. 2 men, he tells us, are travelling together along a road. One of them believes that it leads to the celestial city, the other that it leads nowhere. But since this is the only road there is, both must travel along it. During the journey, they meet with moments of refreshment and delight, and with moments of hardship and danger. All the time, one of them thinks his journey is a pilgrimage. He interprets the pleasant parts of the journey as encouragements and the obstacles as trials of his purpose. The other, meanwhile, believes none of this. But since he has no choice in the matter, he enjoys the good and endures the bad. When they do turn the final corner, it will become apparent that one of them has been right all along and the other wrong. Whilst Hick faced problems, such as whether or not it's the same person before and after death to carry out the verification, or the impossibility of verifying God and heaven even after death, as we would have no foundation to judge this new experience against, nonetheless, he held that they can be verified, and so religious beliefs are meaningful. This is what Hick described as eschatological verification. The ascribing of meaning to something through verification in the time after death. Eschatology is a word which relates to the end times and to life after death. La, 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 la.